In a few minutes, we'll be in the book of James to talk about the series that we've been talking about. But I'm going to ask you, before you turn there, to turn in your Old Testament to 2 Kings chapter 9. 2 Kings 9. I'm going to tell a story from that chapter, and then eventually we'll get to talking about wisdom and why the lesson is the way that it is today. Let me just take a minute to welcome everyone. I was thinking about this while we were worshiping earlier. You know, we always make a big deal about, you know, trying to be reverent and turning off cell phones. And inevitably, there's if you turn off your cell phone, the office phone rings or something goes on. One of the great blessings, I think, that we have as a church is that we have a lot of little kids, a lot of babies. I've been to some places where they don't have children and you never hear a child cry. And I think that's not a good sound in a church. I just want to tell you parents who have little ones just how much I love and appreciate you. Thank you for bringing your kids and wrestling around with them and working through all the uncomfortable months and maybe even a couple years of the noise they make. If anybody ever looks at you sideways about that or you feel embarrassed about that, I just want you to remember that not everybody's got a terrible attitude like that. For those people that do have that attitude that children are a distraction, I'd really like to encourage them to incorporate the sound of children into your worship to God. They are a blessing. I've read that there are some groups of Quakers that when they assemble, they actually just let the kids run around the building and be kids and make noise and play in the, you know, corners and do all of that. And part of the challenge that they're given to all the adults is you just incorporate that in your worship, the sounds of children playing. Don't let it distract you from your worship of God. But I just want you to know that it's an encouragement to me, and I'm thankful for it. And I just hope that you won't be embarrassed by your diligence in being here and not giving up on that. It eventually gets better. My kids only ever make noise every once in a while now, so... Thank you for that. The story I'm about to tell you will eventually illustrate the point that I want to make from James 3 about wisdom. If you look on the chart, what we're going to talk about in a few minutes is that the wisdom that is from above is pure. And I'm actually going to do the June lesson here this morning. And I'll have more to say next month about the wisdom from above. But I wanted to start talking about the idea of purity. Here. This idea that the wisdom from above is first pure, and then we're going to talk about later on this year that it's then peaceable, gentle, reasonable. Let me tell a story from 2 Kings 9 that illustrates this. In 2 Kings 9, there is a lot of bad stuff going on in Israel and in Judah. The house of Ahab, who was not a very good man, had caused a lot of trouble in the nation. And it was actually more about his wife Jezebel. You probably have heard that name before. She was the bigger troublemaker. By this time, Ahab is dead, but his influence, his children, his wife were still being a cancer in the nation of Judah and Israel. God is finally going to deal with it. God's actually going to eradicate the cancer in the nation by destroying the house of Ahab, all of the people that belonged to him, Jezebel included. And the way that he does that is he asks a king, he actually asks a warrior by the name of Jehu to do this for him. The chapter begins by Elisha, the prophet, look at verse 1, sending one of the understudy prophets, one of the sons of the prophets, an unnamed guy. He sends him to anoint Jehu as king of Israel. And when the prophet gets there, he takes Jehu into a room and he says some things to him. Look here at verse 6. He arose and went into the house and he poured the oil on his head and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. You shall strike the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off both Ahab, cut off from Ahab every male person, both bond and free in Israel. I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. The dogs shall eat Jezebel in the territory of Jezreel, and none shall bury her. Then he opened the door and fled. It's this weird scene where this prophet comes in, takes Jehu into a room, pours oil on his head, and says, God's made you king, now go kill all the people that belong to Ahab. I'm out. And he leaves. And he also makes this prediction that Jezebel will be eaten by dogs and that nobody will bury her. Well, that's a strange thing to say because Jezebel's powerful. So are her children and the other people in Ahab's house. They've taken control of the nation. Jehu comes out of that meeting and his buddies say to him, hey, what's going on with this guy? And Jehu tries to brush it off and says, well, you know the guy, he's crazy. And they said, come on, you're lying to us. What really happened? And he said, well, I was just anointed king of Israel. And so they all start saying, hail the king, and they begin to call him king. Now, Jehu in the next section goes on his killing spree. He begins to take off to go take care of business for God. Let me show you what happens in this story as he begins to go toward the place where the kings are and where Jezebel is. Verse 17 says, now the watchman was standing on the tower in Jezreel, and he saw the company of Jehu as he came, and said, I see a company. And Joram said, take a horseman and send to meet him, and let him say, is it peace? So a horseman went to meet him and said, thus says the king, is it peace? And Jehu said, what have you to do with peace? Turn behind me. And the watchman reported, the messenger came to them, but he did not return. Stop there. So there's these guys standing on the wall watching, and they see this crowd of horses coming, a company of people, and they start talking, and they say, I wonder if those guys mean well or not. They don't know who they are yet. So one of the guys gets the job to go out and say, hey, are you coming in peace? So he gets out there and he says, is it peace? And Jehu says, what do you have to do with peace? Get behind me. So the guy gets behind him. They send another messenger in the next couple verses, and the guy asks the same thing, verse 19, is it peace? And Jehu said, what do you have to do with peace? Get behind me. And so they reported again. The guy went out there, but he's not coming back. So finally, Joram, there in verse 21, the king, dresses up, gets ready, goes out and meets Jehu. Verse 22 says, when Joram saw Jehu, he said, is it peace, Jehu? Now, three times, people have said to Jehu, is it peace? And three times, what I kind of hope God would say is, yeah, man, everything's good. Everything's good. Everything's at peace. But the reality was things weren't peaceful. Things weren't okay. So listen to how Jehu responds to King Joram. In verse 22, Joram said to Jehu, is it peace, Jehu? And he said, what peace? So long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many. So Joram reigned about and fled and said to Ahaziah, there is treachery, O Ahaziah. And Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between his arms, and the arrow went through his heart and sank in his chariot. Jehu says, there is no peace. What do you mean peace? As long as your mom is causing all this trouble and doing all these abominations in Israel, there's not going to be peace. And Joram knows that he's in trouble, so he turns around to run, and he gets an arrow in his back. And Jehu then kills Ahaziah next. And then he makes his way to Jezreel. Look at verse 30. Verse 30. When Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. As Jehu entered the gate, she said, is it peace, Zimri, your master's murderer? Stop for a minute. Jezebel's probably heard by now that Jehu is coming and that he's killed two kings. And so she dresses up and paints her face, and she's up in the tower. And he walks through the gate, and she says, "Is it peace, Zimri?" She doesn't call him Jehu, she calls him Zimri. If you look up your Bible history, Zimri was a captain earlier in Israel's history who had assassinated a king, who had overthrown the government. And so she's calling Jehu this name. I love what Jehu does here. Jehu doesn't even talk to Jezebel. Listen to what he says. Verse 32, "Then he lifted up his face to the window and said, 'Who is on my side? Who?' And two or three officials looked down at him." Can you picture that? Jezebel's looking out the window with her painted face. Jehu just looks at the other windows and says, "Hey, is anybody up there on the Lord's side?" And a couple of guys poke out and say, and he says, "Throw her down." And so they grab this awful monster of a woman, painted face and all, and they throw her out of the tower. And she hits the ground, and the Bible says her blood splatters all over the wall. And Jehu's just not moved by that. He steps over the corpse and walks in the house and eats lunch. And while he's eating lunch, after all of that, I guess you get hungry when that happens. He says, "You know, we probably should go out and bury her." Of course, God had predicted she wouldn't be buried. So by the time they get back outside, the dogs have eaten the body of Jezebel, just like God said. Let me ask you a question. Is God a God of peace? When you read stories like this, it confuses people sometimes because they say, how could God have ordered such things like this? Why would God have a woman thrown out of a tower? Why would God kill kings? And I'll tell you that really, biblically speaking, what he was trying to accomplish was peace. But it's a foolish person who thinks that peace can be accomplished without righteousness. That really all the trouble that was being caused in Israel, the death, the murders, the oppression of the poor, was because of wicked people. And if God was ever going to make peace in that nation, he was going to have to do some things that didn't appear to be peaceful. There are other ways to illustrate this. I was going to show you some stuff in Jeremiah, but I'm actually going to try to keep my sermon short this morning. You'll see why afterwards. But let's go to James now, James chapter 3. I want to tell you why I told this story about Jehu. James chapter 3 is talking about wisdom from above versus wisdom from below. Notice verse 13 again. "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, and the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." Now, we've already this year talked a lot about some of the things that have to do with earthly, sensual, and demonic wisdom. But now we're going to just mention at the beginning of this, we're going to, for the rest of the year, talk about the list that's given about heavenly wisdom. Pay attention to the way that this is said. The wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable. Do you know what happens when that gets mixed up? When somebody takes the order and switches them? And says, what I'm going to say is most important in my life, when it comes to wisdom is peace. And being peaceable and kind of getting along with everyone. And they believe that to be the goal of the world, or the goal of the nation, or the goal of their company, or the goal of their family, or the goal of their relationships. If they take the first thing and make it the second thing, and they take the second thing and make it the first thing, they actually begin to destroy the world. I want you to think this through for just a minute. Would you like to see a world at peace? Would you like to see that? I would. It's a foolish person that thinks that that can ever be accomplished by just simply saying, let's all hold hands and be at peace. Because here's the reality. There's evil in the world. People do terrible things. You know what's easy for peace talkers? Not peacemakers, peace talkers. It's easy to hide from that reality. It's easy to go like this and say, why can't everybody be at peace? When they don't know what evil's like. Because you can avoid it, you know. We can live in a country where we don't understand anything about oppression and beheadings and ugliness that takes place in some places. But then somebody gets upset and says, war, you know, like why do people have to fight? Well, go there. Go there and see why sometimes people have to fight. Sometimes people have to fight because if you don't fight, the world's going to destroy itself. That purity would be a better goal there. That if everybody could do what was true, what was right, what was good, in motive and in heart and in behavior, peace would eventually be the result. But when there's not people being right, they begin to destroy what God has created. And God has to deal with that. Let me ask you about this, not from a global perspective, but from a national perspective. You know, there's a lot of talk in the United States right now about peace. Let's be at peace. And we see people who stand up and say there's some things worth fighting for. And you may not understand why they feel oppressed or why they feel like it's worth fighting for. But they do. When people are unjust and unfair and do wrong things, what they know is going to make the world better is for people to be right, be true, be good. And so sometimes peace takes a back seat to stepping up and saying, this is not right. And that gets complicated. Because if you believe in the cause, then you understand it. If you don't believe in the cause, then you don't understand it. But I think some of us Christians are beginning to understand this. You know, we live in a weird time where things like transgender discussions start taking place. And whether or not, you know, a boy can be a girl or a girl can be a boy, or what you're assigned at, your gender's assigned at when you're born, is the gender identity that you have and all that. Somewhere deep down inside, we know this to be the case, don't we? That we can't just close our eyes and say, it doesn't matter what you think, or it doesn't matter whether you tell the truth about who you are. You can just be whatever you want and do whatever you want, and there's no consequence to that. We know that that's going to cause trouble eventually, which is why people get concerned. But again, some people don't believe in your cause. They don't understand why you'd ever say anything about it. Why not just be at peace about it? Let me ask you about a church, not a nation. Let's say the goal of this church was just to be at peace. Yet in this church, there were people who had wrong hearts, wrong attitudes, and wrong teaching. And we said, but don't worry about the bad attitudes and the bad hearts and the bad teaching. Let's just hold hands and say, we're fine. Let's say there's peace here. You know, don't you, that that wouldn't work for very long. that eventually the poison of falsehood would destroy, like a cancer, the community. But look, it's easy to hide in the world, and it's easy to hide in your nation, and it's even easy to hide in a church. But now let's bring it into your house. Has anybody ever seen a family put peace above purity and cause it to destroy the family? I had a friend growing up, actually a bunch of friends. And it seemed like to me that in that those houses, one house in particular, the goal of that house was just to get along. They just wanted to get along, and they wanted it to be quiet and peaceful and everybody to be friends in the house. But they were gluttons. And by gluttons, I mean gluttons. Like, they were literal gluttons. I would go visit their house, and I loved it because we would eat whatever we wanted to eat as much as we wanted to eat. The Bible actually talks about that and says that's not good. The gluttony of that house actually caused health trouble for certain people. But nobody said anything about it. And the gluttony was not just about food. There was gluttony about lust. My best friend's older brother had like this incredible collection of pornography that his parents knew about but weren't going to say anything about because they wanted there to be peace there. The parents had drugs that they kept quiet. But everybody needed to be at peace, so don't say anything about the drugs. Peace was king in that house. Anybody want to guess what happened in that family? You want to guess? The impurity destroyed a lot of lives. My best friend's older brother is now dead. He died because he got to be so big from his gluttony that he just couldn't handle it anymore, and his heart stopped when he was in his early 30s. But wait. I mean, isn't peace the goal? That's right, peace is the goal. But we'll never accomplish peace without right, truth. I'll show you that in a way, but let me just say it like this. Did you know it's easy to hide in a home too? You can hide in a world, you can hide in the nation, you can hide in a church, and you can hide in your home. If there's things going on in your home that aren't right, it's easy to hide. You work more, you know? Or you get a hobby, and you stay away, and you don't deal with it. This becomes more difficult when it's a one-on-one relationship with somebody that you want to love. Husband and a wife, or a child and a parent. The wisdom of God is first pure, then peaceable. And by the way, this is one of the things I like about the parents here, is I think they've got this right. I've seen some of you create a not very peaceful situation for your children a number of times. Like, they're not happy at all. You're making them cry. Yeah, good job. That's good. I appreciate that. And the reason that you choose to make them cry sometimes and not just want to be their buddy and be at peace with them is you know that if you don't teach them to do what's right, it doesn't matter how much of a friend you are to them, that impurity in their life will destroy them someday. It's God's way. This is complicated. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. Because some people who look at purity and say it's got to be above peace, forget that peace is the very second thing said. They think that all that matters is purity, and it doesn't matter whether I'm peaceful in any way. So I'm going to try to tell you that that's not the case. Look at verse 18 again. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now look at that verse again, because something interesting is said. The goal of sowing seed is two things. Righteousness, and the second thing is what? Look at the end of the verse. Peace. here's what I have to believe as a Christian. That I'm not just trying to accomplish peace in the world. I am trying to accomplish peace in the world, but I've got to do it God's way. I've got to plant the seed, and the seed is not peace. The seed is truth. And if I, in my planting of the seed of truth, do it in peace, and that's what the verse says. Pay attention. It's sown in peace. I'm not Jehu. I don't get to go having people thrown out of windows. Now, God, at times in history, took violent men like Jehu and used them that way. That's not what he does with Christians. He says to Christians, you don't take up swords and spears. You beat your swords into plowshares and sickles. You're farmers now. But here's what you got to do. Put truth where it's supposed to be. Plant the seed in peace. And if you do that, eventually what you'll do is you'll make peace that comes from righteousness. Let me ask you something. Are you wanting to do that in your life? You know why it's a struggle to do that? It's because we know what it means for us. It means we become like Jesus. Let me ask you, did Jesus come to bring peace on earth? It's a trick question. The Prince of Peace, he was called. Yet you have Jesus saying things in his ministry in Matthew 10 and in Luke 12 like this. I did not come to bring peace but a sword. Or, I came to kindle a fire on the earth, and oh how I wish it were kindled. You know what he meant by that? Jesus came to grow a crop on the earth. Did you know that farmers sometimes burn their fields? Did you know that? That's weird and violent. They burn their fields. When Jesus said that he had a fire that it was kindled and he wished it was already kindled, I'm going to suggest to you that what he was talking about was farming terms. Look, guys, I came here to grow a crop, but I can't grow a crop until I begin to sort of light up the things that need to be lit up and eliminate the things that are not compatible. But then I'm going to give you guys seed to plant. And you guys are going to be messengers of righteousness and peace. Do you remember this Sermon on the Mount? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, blessed are the peacemakers. Remember that? For they shall be called sons of God. Well, wait a second. For every person that calls you a son of God because you're a peacemaker, do you know what they called the Son of God? They called the Son of God Beelzebub. They called the Son of God a devil. They didn't believe that he was good because what he brought to the world was truth. And the preaching of truth doesn't always produce peace, at least in the moment. If you ever doubt that, look at the cross. All the preaching of Jesus put him there. What was the next thing Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount after he said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God? Do you remember the next one? Blessed are you when men persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. How could he go from being talking about peacemaking to talking about persecution? Well, this is why. People don't like truth. In fact, the very next thing Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount was, you are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. Did you know that light and salt are violent? Did you know that? For somebody that finds comfort in darkness, the most violent thing you can do is open the door when they're trying to sleep. Like, all that light is so annoying. Jesus, in fact, said it this way, men love what? Darkness rather than light. Why you got to shine a light in here? That's not peaceful. Oh, but eventually it will be. Eventually it will be. Why do you got to pour salt in the wound? That's violent. Because if you don't, understand that that wound's going to fester and decay and get infected and destroy the rest of your body, then you don't understand disease. But if the light and the salt of Christianity is the truth of God, then we'll be ambassadors of light and truth, believing with all of our heart that the wisdom of God eventually is going to make peace, but only if we put truth above peace. I hope that gives you some things to think about. Because what it boils down to right now, practically in this lesson about your wisdom and in our lives, here's the key. For us to be wise like God wants us to be wise, to be those that practice the wisdom from above, we have to recognize that our devotion is first and foremost to God's truth and purity. The beginning of wisdom, the proverb says, is the fear of conflict. Right? Is that what it says? The beginning of wisdom is the appreciation of comfort. Is that right? The beginning of wisdom is for everyone to get along. No, let's let the proverb speak. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. It's the beginning. I'm not trying to say that we ever get to be violent. We don't. The seed needs to be sown in peace by those who are wanting to make peace. But I can't get this wrong. In my relationships, in my family, in my workplace, in my nation, in my world, in my church, I've got to operate the way God designed wisdom to operate. So, let's end the lesson with this invitation. I love you, I do, all of you. Some of you who are visiting, maybe you're not members of this congregation, maybe you aren't even Christians. I love you, and I want to tell you that everything's good. And I want to give you a hug and say you're fine as you are. But here's the reality. You're not. There isn't really any peace, and there won't be for eternity for you or for us together unless you believe what's true about God. That Jesus is the Son of God. And that you need to have your sins forgiven. And I know that's not easy to hear. And I'm not trying to be mean by telling you about this. But I am trying to make peace happen in your life. Someday it will. In fact, God's peace begins to work right away. But it's not because I pretend there's peace. It's because I put truth above peace. If you're not a Christian, think about becoming one this morning. If you need our prayers or help, please come forward and let us know how we can help you while we stand and sing together.